Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson, and I'm here with my friend Liz Reitzig. She is a graduate of the University of Maryland. She's also a raw milk activist. She works on food freedom issues. Liz, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. It's great to be here.
So I saw this great clip from John Stossel from a show that he did called Illegal Everything, and he was talking about raw milk activism, and I'd like to listen to the clip, and then let's talk about it, all right?
Yep.
And if you sell certain things that the food police disapprove of, you better watch out.
There was a loud banging on the back gate.
And I said, what's going on? It goes, we have a warrant to search the premises.
Not long ago, federal and state officials raided Rawsome Foods, a food co-op in Los Angeles.
They started walking around. They drew their guns, and I'm like, why are you drawing guns?
They searched me. It seemed like they thought we had cocaine in the papayas or something.
Their crime was selling milk that hadn't been pasteurized.
They just went into our freezer, and they just took gallons and cheeses and whatever they wanted.
A year later, the government raided again. They also raided Sharon Palmer's farm, which supplies Rawsome with its natural food.
These people come and invade, ripped my house apart. They took me down to the county jail, booked me, photographed me like a criminal.
Palmer and Rawsome's owners were charged with 6 felonies. They could go to jail. All because
health officials say raw milk can be downright dangerous.
It can. Unpasteurized means the milk hasn't been heated to kill the bacteria like salmonella that can give you stomach aches or kill you. But raw food buyers say things like this.
It's pure and healthy and makes me feel good.
Oh, please. That's ridiculous. But don't free people have a right to be ridiculous?
All right, so Liz, Stossel is saying what a lot of libertarians are usually say. They say that you should have the right to do whatever you want with your body as long as you harm no one else. But he also had some misgivings about pasteurization. So what do you think, how do you approach trying to convince people why people should be able to eat whatever they want or drink whatever they want, even if it may be something that society deems as harmful?
Well, first of all, it's entirely normal just to contract or to work directly within your community for food sources. Mm-hmm. Second of all, even if there's a discrepancy between what you think should be available and what is, it's a question of whether or not these peaceful acts should be criminalized. Mm-hmm. And what's happening right now is that because of the restrictions placed on the farmers, they're criminalized for providing food peacefully to their communities.
And when you say criminalized, we're talking about raids. Like, the feds will raid you. They're sticking guns in people's faces for doing nothing more than what people have done for thousands of years, milking cows and feeding the milk to their children.
That's absolutely right. It goes with armed federal marshals on farms with plenty of children. There's the raids are just, some of them are just unspeakable. Just the things that have happened on these small farms to these families, children at gunpoint for upwards of 8 hours, and all because people are feeding their communities peacefully.
So what's at the forefront right now? You were telling me earlier before we were talking about the podcast about legislation that's being introduced in a couple of states, one in your home state of Maryland and one in my home state of Virginia. Tell me about the Maryland bill. What are they trying to do here?
In Maryland, the bill addresses cow shares. Mm-hmm. Now, very briefly, cow shares are an arrangement where people who don't live on a farm can actually own a cow or own part interest in a cow, and then they can get the milk from their own animal. Mm-hmm. And those were banned in Maryland in 2006. The health department changed the wording of a regulation specifically to ban cow shares.
Why?
Well, that's a really good question, right? In their minds, raw milk is very dangerous, and nobody should drink it for any reason ever. Mm-hmm. And so they want to use their positions to force their worldview on the rest of us.
What if I think raw milk is dangerous, but I don't want to ban it? I mean, like, the thing is that, like, it's hard for me to try and explain it to people because I want to try and explain it to people from the moralist perspective. They have the right to do it. But, I mean, do you sort of discount the message of critics? I mean, do you discount pasteurization? I mean, do you really think that pasteurization is not, it makes it less healthy?
I know enough about the topic that yes, and I could talk to you for hours about the differences between pasteurized milk and raw milk and the benefits of raw milk and some of the flaws with pasteurization and why it started to begin with. I mean, there was a reason why it started, right. And we don't have that reason anymore. So it's not necessary anymore.
Right. Oh, so we have a lot cleaner methods of getting the milk, right?
Absolutely. And we have closed milking systems. We have basic sanitation. We have refrigerated trucking. These are some of the reasons that pasteurization became necessary in the cities at the turn of the century.
Oh, interesting. To expand on that, because this is probably going to help make the case.
Well, for example, what was going on in some of the inner cities at the turn of the century was the dairies were being moved into the cities, mm-hmm. and the cows were being fed the waste from the distilleries. So this was an investment opportunity for investors, not farmers.
Oh.
They were not treating the cows the way cows are designed to be treated.
Right.
They were not eating grass. And the milk they were producing was very poor quality. There was also the open milking systems. So workers were hand milking into buckets, mm-hmm. and often the workers were sick. Rampant TB at the time. And so the milk would get diseased.
Oh.
And there was also no refrigerated trucking. So combine all those factors. And the infant mortality rates in those cities were upwards of 50%.
So the pasteurization at the time was really necessary because of all of those external factors.
Well, in a way, but let's look at what happened. There were two campaigns that started, mm-hmm. rivaling campaigns. One was for certified clean raw milk. Mm-hmm. And that would have been a program where some of the outlying farms would have been certified, uh-huh. and they would have provided the raw milk for those children in the cities. The other campaign was for mandatory pasteurization, and that was seen as more efficient. And uh-huh. so that's the one that won out.
Interesting. Wow. All right, so let's talk about this bill in Virginia. This is kind of interesting. So what's happening with the Virginia Food Freedom bill that we're talking about here?
There were actually two bills in Virginia, so I don't want to get them confused. One was for a lot more on-farm processing. It was kind of a home kitchens bill. Mm-hmm. And that one died.
Okay.
That one's no longer. Okay. The other one, I believe it's HB 268 and SB 51. Mm-hmm. That one's still going.
Okay.
And it's going to be voted on, I believe, on Thursday mm-hmm. in the Senate. That one allows for expanded on-farm activities without county licensure and also on-farm sales. So right now, if you're a farmer in Virginia, you can sell certain products on your farm. This opens it up a little bit so that you can also sell some of your neighbor's products as well.
Interesting. Interesting.
It's a very common sense bill.
Would you say that that humans, we've evolved to consume a different diet than the one that most people eat today? Do you think that what I mean by that is that do you think that people are their immune systems can take this because the thing is that humans evolve and they adapt and change according
yeah.
to our environmental factors. So I'm curious, if raw milk was more widespread, do you think that people would be more sick or less sick?
Well, just based on my research and reading all about nutrition for the past 10 years, I think if clean, safe raw milk were more widely available, we'd see less asthma,
uh-huh.
much less allergies, especially in children. We'd see improved immunity. We would see these general health.
Now the thing yeah. is, I've read about studies where people who consume honey from bees that are local actually have increased resistance to allergies
mm-hmm.
because since they're consuming the honey from the allergens, the pollen that's in their area, they're more resistant to it because they're consuming it and their body develops more of a tolerance. Is it kind of the same thing with milk?
Well, it's a little bit different than the honey because the honey is a very direct thing because you're actually getting the pollen from the plants that you might have allergies to.
Mm-hmm.
But with the milk, it's much more of an increasing your general immune system.
Mm-hmm.
So our entire bodies are covered in microorganisms.
Right.
We have like a 10-to-1 ratio of bacteria to human cells. Mm-hmm. And keeping those bacteria alive and in balance and happy, that's one of our best defenses against any kind of disease. And so what raw milk does is it helps provide some of those probiotics to our bodies. It also helps with some of the enzymes. You know, we have a limited number of enzymes available to us our whole lives. So the more we can bring enzymes into our body or on our bodies or whatever, then the more we're going to have the benefits from that.
Now, you rightly point out that we take all sorts of dietary risks every single day. I just ate at Chipotle and I drank a Coca-Cola Classic. So somewhere in there, I'm sure I got something kind of nasty. But the CDC says that unpasteurized milk is 150 times more likely to cause foodborne illness than pasteurized dairy products. Now, is that a greater risk than other foods, or do you doubt the CDC's data?
I doubt that data.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some analysis going on right now of that data, and I can provide you with some really concrete numbers in a few more days, but that analysis is still happening.
Okay.
But basically, there's some illnesses that are associated with raw milk, but they're never confirmed. And so when they group that in, mm-hmm. it's a little bit misleading to mm-hmm. consumers. And also when they say raw milk, I believe that in that statistic that you're quoting, mm-hmm. they're compiling raw milk cheeses, queso fresco, which is a raw milk cheese that's often called bathtub cheese. Huh. And it's because it's made
in a bathtub.
In a bathtub. And it's often imported from Mexico.
Interesting.
And so it's important to look at fluid raw milk and the statistics associated with fluid raw milk and not confuse that with raw milk cheeses.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I'm a big proponent of food freedom, and all of these issues that you talk about are the kind of things that any, you know, libertarian like myself would absolutely stand behind you on. But I want to talk about another issue, and it's something that actually we've covered at the Libertarian Republic before. It was the story about feral pigs. And I heard a bunch of pigs raided a pig farm what state is this? What happened? Can you fill us in on the story, if you wouldn't mind?
Yeah, it's the story of Mark Baker in Michigan.
Mark Baker.
He is a pork farmer.
Okay.
He raises heritage breed of pig, which is called a Mengalista.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very proud of this. You know, he's bred them to breed in certain characteristics, and mm-hmm. he's got an amazing herd.
Mm-hmm.
And he was selling his product to local restaurants in the, well, local is relative. He's
right.
way far out, so the local ones are a couple hours away. But it was a thriving business. He was able to support his family, and his farm was able to sustain itself mm-hmm. through that. And the Michigan DNR, Department of Natural Resources,
right.
they put in a declaratory ruling saying that all farmers who had feral pigs had to destroy, depopulate their herds.
So what you're saying is that he had a certain breed of pig on his farm. He hadn't committed any crimes to that point.
Right.
And then the government essentially made him a criminal through an act of legislation and demanded that he kill his livestock?
There was no act of legislation. This is a bureaucracy changing a piece of regulation.
Really?
And they were, let's just say, influenced by the pork industry.
Oh, so the pork industry didn't like the competition.
Exactly.
But what they were saying was that these animals might at some point escape, and if they do escape, then they'll harm. Because feral pigs are a problem in certain states. You know, there's a lot of problems when the pigs do get out, if they do get out, then they cause damage to local livestock and flora, you know, flora and fauna. So, you know, there's definitely some misgivings here, but the government seems to be acting, you know, without legislation in an unconstitutional manner and taking away this man's right to earn a livelihood. What do you say?
Well, first of all, feral pigs are not an issue in Michigan.
Okay.
They're just not. And second
they
of all,
are in some states like Louisiana and Florida, I believe, they have a problem with these pigs.
Right. Well, Michigan's like on the other side of the country for this. But
it,
they're just not an issue in Michigan. Mm-hmm. And the way that the DNR defined a feral pig mm-hmm. is that they named many different characteristics,
mm-hmm.
like a straight tail or a curly tail, and skeletal structure, and the pigs having hair or not having hair.
It's pretty specific.
Oh, no. It's specific, but very general. Any pig can have any of those characteristics.
Interesting. Why would they do that?
Well, it's selective targeting. And because of the declaratory ruling, several of the farms that were raising pigs,
uh-huh.
not feral pigs, they had them enclosed,
uh-huh.
depopulated their herds.
So they did kill their
several of the farms did.
Did this guy, Mark Davis, is that his name?
Mark Baker.
Mark Baker. So Mark Baker, what's the name of his farm, do you know?
Baker's Green Acres.
Baker's Green Acres. So you can Google it, ladies and gentlemen. Mark Baker from Baker's Green Acres. So did he have to kill his
Well, herd? He was ordered to by April 1st, 2012. And he said no. He had a perfectly healthy herd of pigs. He was doing nothing wrong.
None of them had ever escaped.
They're not feral. No. This was not even an issue. Mm-hmm. And he said no, and he turned around and he sued the state to ask for clarification of the declaratory ruling. Mm-hmm. They have not given it yet, but his trial is set for March 11th, where he expects to have an answer.
Interesting. So what has been your involvement in this? Have you, like, contacted Mark? Have you been, like, you know, doing some fundraising, perhaps, to help him with litigation and stuff? Like, what's been your involvement?
Well, I'm pretty involved in a lot of these cases around the country where a small change in regulation criminalizes a farmer, or they get criminally charged for something else. And I've Mark and I have gotten to be very close friends through the whole process, just kind of supporting in a support capacity, because here's somebody who's facing losing his entire livelihood, his everything he knows and loves right now. And that's pretty intense when you think about it. And so we're kind of organizing around him. His legal fees are being paid by the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund.
Who are they?
The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund is an organization that's really grown around some of the assaults happening on to our farmers. And they come in and offer legal support to farmers who are criminally charged or cases like Mark's.
Are there any other cases going on around, like, are there other feral pig farmers that are, like, teaming up with them?
No, there's not, because this is not an issue in any other state right now. And there were a few in Michigan, but they have chosen a different option rather than pursuing the long, drawn-out legal case against the state.
Now, I read your article. It's up on lewrockwell.com. You said it's kind of old, but you basically have said, you know, hey, I'm a scofflaw, and I am going to defy the state of Maryland, which, you know, a bad law is no law at all, in my mind, and I applaud you for that, because it does take courage and bravery. But has the government come after you at all, Liz? Have you had any problems? I mean, I know you actively participate in the creation of raw milk. You do import it across state lines, which, is that a felony?
It's a federal offense.
It's a federal offense. Yeah. Okay. And,
so that was what the article was addressing specifically.
Right.
Because it's not available in my state, it means that if I want raw milk for myself and my children, mm-hmm. I've got to go out of state to get it. In the process of bringing that back to Maryland, I'm committing a federal offense.
Okay, you're saying this. So, I mean, I'm not going to tell the feds where you're at. I don't want them to know where you're at, but I mean,
they know it already.
Why didn't they haven't come after you? You haven't had any retribution? I mean, come on.
As of now, no.
Really? Do you fear retribution?
Seeing what they do to the farmers, I get concerned sometimes. And the threats that they make to some of the moms in other states. I have concerns, but it's not what predominates.
So you don't sit around worrying about it?
I don't.
You know you got some friends to come bail you out, though, if you ever get in
trouble? I don't think it's the fight they want to pick.
Probably not.
They prefer to go after isolated farmers.
Yeah.
And that's been their MO so far.
Right. Well, speaking of someone who works in propaganda, I can say that you probably don't want to have this beautiful blonde woman sit in the front of your magazine showing that you arrested this lady, because this would be a poster child for the tyranny of big government. Now, Liz, I want to move on to something, just kind of a funny story. It's a personal story, and we'll make this, like, you know, part of the longer podcast that people can download if they want. But I want to talk about how you and I met, because I think people will laugh, because I have to actually mea culpa here. I have to make an apology based on my wrong-headed prejudices. You and I met in the green room at Russia Today, and the story behind this was that I was there to debate Tom Hartman, I think, about something. I can't remember what the show was. Were you on Tom Hartman too? Is that what it was?
No.
What was the show?
The show I was on was Megan Lopez.
Megan Lopez, right. So
she was the interviewer, and she wanted an update from the Vernon Hirschberger trial in Wisconsin, and then some of the GMO issues that were going on.
Interesting, GMOs. Okay. Oh, I definitely want to talk about GMOs, but I want to tell this funny story. I want to tell this funny story because this just goes to show you, ladies and gentlemen, how wrong you can be sometimes and why you need to keep an open mind. But, you know, again, maybe you won't blame me. I was there in the Russia Today green room, and, you know, when you're at Russia Today, what do you expect? You're surrounded by communists, left leftist socialists usually. I mean, most of the people that I meet there are from like Mother Jones or, you know, the Center for American Progress, you know, and Think Progress and Alternate and hardcore lefties. So I just assumed that that's, you know, what you were. So we started talking and we were getting into this good conversation and stuff, but I was really nervous because I didn't want to talk to Liz because I assumed that she was trying to destroy me from the communist government. Because, you know, everybody knows that Russia Today is a Kremlin, you know, funded outfit. So I thought that maybe, you know, she was probably with some left-leaning group and, you know, talking about GMOs and things like that. I assumed that if I talk to Liz and give her any information, she will destroy me. But I was so wrong because then I saw Liz a couple of months later at, what was it, LPAC? Libertarian Political Action Conference. And I was like, wait a minute, what? She's just a libertarian. Oh, my God. So I just have to say, mea culpa, I'm sorry for prejudging you. I didn't want to talk to you or be a friend because I thought that maybe you were going to be a communist and you wanted to hurt me. So that's actually how Liz and I met, which is a funny story. But you were talking about GMOs. GMOs is something I like to talk about because I love GMOs. I'm a big fan of GMOs. And I think GMOs are great. I think I'm not totally opposed to organic food in principle. Again, I think you should be able to eat whatever you want. But a lot of the research that I've done, the difference between organic food and GMOs is that it takes a lot more resources. It's wasteful to do organic food versus GMOs. The reason why people cultivate genetically modified food was because we get a higher crop yield. Norman Borlaug, who worked for Monsanto for a number of years, is credited with saving nearly a billion lives because of GMOs, because the higher crop yield led to less starvation in Africa. And Penn and Teller did a really great show about this, about organic foods and GMOs. And don't be afraid to confront me. I mean, again, I'm not a scientist or an expert here. You're the expert on this. This is why I brought you in here. So tell me why I'm wrong about GMOs.
Well, gosh, that's just a big open invitation
there. Yeah, get it.
Where to start even? Okay, I want to start with organic.
Oh, do it. Tell me.
So organic is a term that's owned by the USDA.
Okay.
So if you just look at the organic that's owned by the USDA, you're going to get a completely different set of data than you are if you look at kind of what does organic really mean?
Mm-hmm.
And when you apply it to agriculture, what it's come to mean here now in this day and in this area,
mm-hmm.
it means that food is sustainably produced. Mm-hmm. And by sustainably, I really mean sustainably, not the sustainable agriculture legal term.
Okay.
And another way of looking at it is kind of in harmony with how the natural world works.
Yeah. Don't be shy. Tell me.
Well, there's a lot there.
I want to hear it.
There's a lot.
I want to hear it.
There's a farmer in Virginia. You've probably heard of him, Joel Salatin.
Oh, yeah.
And he does a great job explaining how his farm mimics the way animals live in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
He does a much better job and says it much more eloquently than I ever could. So I just want to point everybody to
Google him, Joel Salatin.
His video, Salatin.
Salatin, excuse
yeah.
me.
Mm-hmm. And his videos and his writing, he's an excellent writer, very entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And he just hits the nail on the head every single time.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'd like to emphasize, though, is that organic agriculture, the way, like natural agriculture, not the term organic, the
okay.
legal term, but real organic agriculture, the way it mimics nature means that the resources are used very efficiently.
Mm-hmm.
So with the GMOs and crop yield and resources, you get a mixed bag with that because there's some data that says, oh, this is great. And then there's a lot of data that says, actually, no, it's not. And the increased use of pesticides and herbicides poses their own environmental problems.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'd also like to point out, since we're talking about how to work in harmony with the natural world, when you take a GMO crop, let's not even get into the science of putting one species into another species.
Okay.
But when you take that and you grow a certain amount to feed a certain population and you import all this food from here to there, you're creating a completely unsustainable system. So I'm really all for community interdependence and community support for food.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you're going to get the resources that area can provide,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have those, the population is going to be based on the resources that can be provided, the
mm-hmm.
raw materials and the resources that mm-hmm. geographic area can provide. So we're not going to get an artificially inflated population in any one particular area mm-hmm. where the resources cannot sustain that population. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're turned upside down right now mm-hmm. in terms of world population here and there and everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's something I think that it's a good idea to look at in terms of long term. And this is not about population control or anything like that. It's just about getting back into some sort of balance.
But you said that word population control. Harmony. But that, when we talk, you know, GMOs online, we're talking about Monsanto, you know, it everything comes down to eventually, it seems like, you know, we're talking about Bill Gates population control and like this fear of, you know, of vaccines perhaps and all that stuff. We won't get into that. But it seems to me it just a little bit kooky because when I look at, for example, Norman Borlaug and Monsanto, I see that, you know, in the third world that these non-organic crops, these genetically modified crops, have saved so many lives because of that increased yield. And I mean, is there something to be said for that? I mean,
I don't know the research that you're looking at, so I can't speak to that. But I can tell you that based on the research I've done on GMOs, that's a complete myth. There is no increase in yield for GMOs.
So you think Penn and Teller's BS was BS? This whole episode? Did you ever see that episode?
I did not see that episode that you're referring to. I'm sorry.
If you don't know, ladies and gentlemen, Penn and Teller's BS, you know, bull, you know, whatever you call it, was a show on Showtime. I think they lasted 8 seasons, and they debunked a lot of woo-woo is what they called it. But one of the episodes that they did dealt with organic foods, and it actually had a profound impact on me because when I started researching, I found out about this guy who was one of the heads of Monsanto for a while. His name is Norman Borlaug, and he was credited with saving a billion lives because of his work creating genetically modified food. And one of the things that they talked about was the fact that all food is genetically modified, in a sense, because, for example, if you look at a banana, without any chemical additives or anything, or you know, hardcore, I guess, genetic modification as you would think of it from a scientific sense, the banana, the banana that humans eat nowadays, is very different from the wild banana. So the wild banana has seeds, and it's not something that's really that edible. But the banana that we eat today is a genetically modified fruit. Well, humans have been genetically modifying food for thousands of years.
Well, this is entirely different. What you're talking about is kind of selective breeding.
Okay.
But that's
genetic modification, correct?
No. Okay. Not in the way that we're using that term now to mean a genetically modified organism.
Tell me how I'm wrong.
So farmers have been selectively breeding, I can't think of the word for crops right now, but where they take the best of the best mm-hmm. and they use that to get their yield the following year. But it's all within that same species of plant.
So you're saying it's a crossbreeding of plants that's
the
problem.
Well, the genetically modified foods that we're talking about now is when scientists in a lab mm-hmm. take a gene of a virus, for example, and splice it into a corn plant.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all this laboratory technology. These genes are never, these bits of DNA are never intended to be part of the DNA of corn, mm-hmm. but they're artificially put in there. Mm-hmm. But
can't you say the same thing about the banana? I mean, even though you're splicing genes across different species, I mean, the banana was never intended to be eaten without its seeds and, you know, and to have been pollinated, you know, with the best products that we have. I mean, we have genetically modified food. We have genetically modified dogs. We have genetically modified people, in a sense. But, I mean, again, you know, in a sense, I think the thing is that people look at, they call it Frankenfood.
Right.
You know, and they sort of look at it as if it's dangerous. But a lot of the research that I've had is that, you know, GMO food is not necessarily dangerous. A lot of the problems that I see that people level at GMOs and against corporations like Monsanto is the crony capitalism involved, where these corporations will go to the government and they will lobby and they will, you know, restrict small farms. You know, I've heard about things like cross-pollination of seeds, where like farmers are getting sued for patents and like there's, you know, seeds that are self-terminating and things like that. So, you know, what is your biggest beef with GMO foods? If you could say, what's the biggest problem? Is it crony capitalism, or do you really think that these foods are actually dangerous?
I think that genetically modified organisms pose a huge environmental and health hazard. Okay. Absolutely.
Why?
And I think that, well, several reasons. I also think that the crony capitalism is a huge issue that cannot be separated because it exists. We can't say, oh, it's okay over here, but the crony capitalism part of it isn't. Because frankly, I have doubts as to whether or not the genetically modified foods would exist if there was not government subsidies.
Interesting.
Yeah. you mentioned with the crony capitalism, what was it you just...
We're talking about how Monsanto gets, incentives, monetary incentives, and then they have cross-pollination of seeds, and they're suing small farmers.
Yeah, right. And then they're protected in court, essentially.
Right.
But there's also the fact that there's huge government subsidies on commodity crops.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking corn, cotton, soy, canola, huge subsidies.
Sure.
And those are the primary GMO crops.
Right.
So they get propped up in several different ways. It's also those crops are what get turned into food that goes into our school lunch program.
Mm-hmm.
So on every level of production and processing and getting it to people, it's subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
So would these foods even actually exist without government subsidies? I don't know. Then there's the whole issue of the fact that the genetically modified crops that we're growing right now were designed specifically to withstand higher levels of chemicals.
Right.
And that in and of itself is an environmental hazard.
But isn't that a desirable effect? I mean, the reason they do that is because we want to have safer food. I mean, the idea is that, you know, we're in a war against viruses and bacteria. And so we use science and technology to sort of stay ahead of the race. And I mean, don't you agree with that?
I don't understand the connection you're making. So please help me understand. The higher levels of chemicals, like pesticides and herbicides that we're putting on the crops that we're then eating.
Right. But
how
I mean,
is that?
Because the way that those pesticides are engineered is that they're not dangerous to humans. I mean, there was the big DDT scare, you know, throughout the 1950s and 60s, we were using DDT because we found out that it was actually harming the environment. And so we pulled back the use of that, you know, science backed that up.
Right.
But a lot of modern technology today is about building pesticides and herbicides that are non-toxic to humans, but you think they are.
Oh, absolutely. And there's just a world of research to back that up.
But the only problem is that I read the research that's backed up on sites like Natural News that writes, you know, I say, you can't see her face now, ladies and gentlemen, but she just rolled her eyes big time. You know, there's a lot of kooky stuff that they write on these websites, Natural News, and they share it on sites like InfoWars and Prison Planet. And you ladies and gentlemen out there, you know that I'm not a big fan of Alex Jones and his ilk or the health ranger over at Natural News, because I think they spread a lot of bunk. And I don't like seeing these things, these ideas associated with the raw food movement, because I think it discredits people like Liz to be associated with them, because I know that what she's basically doing is arguing for the right to know what it is that you're eating, and that's going to get us up into labeling foods, which I want to talk about. I know this is a huge subject,
yeah.
Liz, but again, what do you think about these institutions like, you know, Natural News and some of the science that they're pushing on these things?
I'm not going to speak to that.
Oh, no. Wow.
What I can say is that just in general, I think it's really important to get to the crux of the research. And I know it takes some homework,
mm-hmm.
but it's totally worth it. And when
Where should we look?
I would start with Institute for Responsible Technology, Environmental Working Group, Center for Food Safety.
Listen to those ladies and gentlemen. You're going to want to write those down. Say that for me again. Institute for Responsible Technology?
Yes, they're focused completely on the GMO issue.
What
Environmental
else?
Working Group. They probably have a kind of a liberal sort of angle to things, but they've got some really good information, including a database of all the government subsidies that go in the Farm Bill. Not all the government subsidies, but Farm Bill related government subsidies, crop insurance, crop subsidies, direct subsidies,
mm-hmm.
all of that. And looking at that can be very enlightening.
People want to know this stuff, Liz,
yeah.
but what they don't want is to go to some website like Natural News where they're going to read some crazy conspiracy theory about the Colorado shooter next to their natural foods.
I'm not into alarmist news at all.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm not either.
It's important to look at the facts.
Oh, yeah, I mean...
The facts give enough evidence all by themselves.
My viewers are going to love that. All right, I want to touch on one last topic before we move on, because this is a really big sticking point with libertarians when it comes to food freedom and all of that. What is your position on labeling GMO foods, the mandatory labeling?
Mandatory labeling of GMO foods.
Yes.
Are we talking federal or state?
Either one.
Well,
both.
I have a conflicted position on that.
Uh-oh.
I really do.
Uh-oh.
I'm not for extra force anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that. I don't like that idea. I think that...
So you're against coercion.
I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And...
So what would you say if both the states and the government were to pass laws requiring the labeling of GMO foods?
I would say that I would want some input in what those laws are going to say.
But you wouldn't oppose them?
On principle, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In realism, I think it's really important to recognize that there's some pretty strong forces working on this issue already,
mm-hmm.
and some of those forces are very undesirable.
Yeah,
and would come out that would be even worse than
right. In a realist world, you know, the corporations are going to try and pass a law that's going to exempt them from from any kind of culpability or responsibility.
But small farmers would be affected, for example.
Right.
So, I think one of the biggest things that could have the greatest impact on this issue is getting rid of the farm subsidies,
mm-hmm.
getting rid of the crop insurance. We're talking the farm bill that just passed. That's a $956 billion piece of legislation.
That's right. That's
right. It allocates $956 billion. I mean, can you even imagine that? I mean, when I think about a piece of legislation that
huge,
yeah. it's 1,000 pages long. I just kind of go into overwhelm. I'm like, whoa, there is nothing I can do about that. And I think a lot of people kind of feel that same way, where that's just almost impossible to tackle. Now, about 80% of that funding is allocated for food stamp programs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even going to touch that. But
well, I will touch it, ladies and gentlemen. Cut those food stamps.
But again, okay, I will touch it. Most of that money for food stamps goes to subsidize those commodity crops.
Of
so
course.
Again, we're
That's
talking
why farmers
about
support these things. You
constant
know?
Control.
Strange
it's all
bedfellows.
About control of our food. And where is that control coming from? It's coming from the crony capitalism that you just talked about, where these corporations are getting essentially funded to produce inferior food.
Hmm. Liz, do you have a website or anything that you write on regularly? Or where?
I do. It's my blog, Nourishing Liberty.
Nourishing Liberty.
Nourishingliberty.com.
Great. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, you guys need to go to nourishingliberty.com if you want to find out more. Is there anything else you'd like to plug? You got a Facebook or a Twitter?
Well, I would just really like to say that it's Mark Baker's trial that's coming up on March 11th. Anybody who can get out there for that. It's a very precedent-setting case.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking forward to setting the precedent we want to see happen. And the more people who come out and support, the more likely that is to happen.
This has been a great conversation, Liz. I really appreciate your time. Oh. Thank you for answering it. This is a tough question, so I really appreciate it. Not a lot of people, you know, have the chutzpah to be able to stand up to some of these tough questions, but I really appreciate it. And now we've got some more information that we can go to. The Institute for Responsible Technology, the Environmental Working Group. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're interested.
Center for Food Safety.
So if you, ladies and gentlemen, are interested in the fight for food freedom, you want to check out what Liz Reitzig is doing at her blog and at some of these places to get more information. Did you want to say something else?
Well, those three websites are focused on the GMO issue.
And I would encourage you, ladies and gentlemen, to look up Norman Borlaug. If you're skeptical, if you're more on the Liz Reitzig side of this, not the skeptical side of things, then take a look at Norman Borlaug. And read a little bit more about Monsanto. I think the skepticism is healthy, it's rational. We need to have a good debate about these things. And I think that we had a really good discussion here today that's really going to advance the dialogue. And if anything, we found out that we still agree on these major issues, that the government should not have any business subsidizing major corporations or choosing what it is that we can or can't do with our bodies. So thank you very much for listening to the Freedom Report. And don't forget every day to check us out at the top of the LibertarianRepublic.com. We are your home for economic freedom and personal liberty.